Okay, maybe we'll just come back and see if we got anything on that. Were you guys able to report out differences in your experience? Did they match any of the numbers we had on the screen?
We were surprised that Spain wasn't happier.
That Spain won what?
Wasn't happier.
Yeah, you thought the Spanish... Yes, we had a student in the other class who had done a year abroad in Spain, and he had some interesting observations. You thought the Spanish people... Well, their negative affect is pretty low, but yeah, they don't have a very high reported positive affect. And that's from visiting the culture, you were surprised by that?
Yeah, I guess just like the way that I saw that they lived their lives, and the people who I met seemed pretty happy. Mm-hmm. Just like their lifestyle and
yeah.
Value.
Sure, good. So that's a potential mismatch. Good, yeah. Others? How many of you have traveled to countries and noticed just a qualitative difference in the feel of people having fun in that country versus the feel of people having fun in this country? Somebody in the last class, a guy who'd been to Spain, was describing this. He said, "Why don't you see how you go? People, it just feels different."
Yeah. I lived in Canada, mm-hmm. and even though they're like right next to each other, it just seems like Canadian people as a whole are very like, oh, it's no worries.
Yeah.
They have like many less worries than we do. They're not that far apart from each other on the scale, but...
Yeah, actually, yeah, we're pretty similar. I would have predicted that Canadians had a lower
negative
affect
yeah.
than... They have a slightly lower negative affect than us, average.
I would have expected that.
But I'm not surprised that their peaks are not higher than ours. Yeah, good. Others? Yeah.
I've been to China before.
Yeah.
Just surrounded by family. That's like when I noticed that Asians are like the most happy.
So if you when you compare that, like you see a family eating somewhere in China, and you see a kind of contentment, you see they seem happy. Does it seem very similar to a family eating when you see go to a restaurant downtown in Spokane, and you see a family eating, or is there a different mood
different.
To it?
It's different. I think family's surprised, and like here's.
Oh, right. It would be an extended family. It would
yeah.
also be cousins and... Right.
So it's like a party in itself.
Right. So there's a different mood because of the number as well. Good. Others? Yeah, this is the kind of stuff I'm getting at. What are some of the qualitative differences in happiness that map onto some of the numbers? Or don't? I mean, in one case, we had a difference there. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so that's kind of just to get our feet wet. You know, there are pretty significant differences. I don't think they're measurement... illusions. I think they're real differences, but Diener is one of the big measurement people in happiness studies. So you get a fair amount on measurement here. Fortunately, we've actually talked about a lot of this already. So let's go fast through the measurement points here. So these are methodological difficulties. Take a couple of notes on them just so you have a sense of. We're going to repeat some things we've said, but one thing we didn't talk about was artifacts as a problem in measurement. So that's a slightly technical term. I just want to mention that an artifact, it comes up in the article, right? Is this a real measure or is it distorted by an artifact? An artifact would be a distorting influence in a survey study especially. And artifacts could be things like different ways of administering a survey, written, oral, moment-to-moment variations. You know, maybe you give the survey on a sunny day. Are people affected? There's a method question. Are people affected by the mood when you ask them a life satisfaction question? So do you guys rate your lives happier because it's a beautiful day today? So that would be an artifact, right? Because that would be something that would distort the measurement. And so artifacts could include cluster effects that throw things off. We talked about that last time. You know, it's hard to study wealth in isolation from the other things it tends to come with in societies, like rights, equality, fulfillment of needs. Wealthy societies tend to have social safety nets. Wealthy societies tend to be individualistic. So those are clustered effects. We've talked before about how puzzling it is that people in very poor countries report happiness. So we see this again with transnational similarities. Most people in most countries judge themselves to be happy, suggesting there's a kind of psychological adjustment mechanism. We don't judge ourselves, our happiness, by an absolute scale. Well, I'm in the, you know, you guys are in the 99th percentile of wealth in the world, right? You know, in terms of your membership in this wealthy culture. You know, but you wouldn't judge your happiness by that absolute scale, right? So we learn that again in this, that there's a kind of group relativity to happiness judgments. We learn again here that validity is, the validity of self-reports is supported by multiple measures. Interesting weird detail here, not consistent with the others, but I always find this fascinating that Russians and U.S. students were compared, and Russians have, this is an interesting detail, kind of gets us behind the numbers a little more. Russian students report much lower levels of well-being than U.S. students, but they also scored lower on event memory measure of subjective well-being. So event memory bias is a phenomenon that's been studied pretty well in psychology, and it has to do with whether you recall events well or not, and whether you recall positive and negative events equally well. Just get that in your notes. Event memory bias is pretty important for happiness. Event memory bias is the tendency some people have to not be able to recall events, and the tendency people have to recall relatively fewer, more positive or negative events. I have a really strong, comically strong negative memory. Positive memory bias. In other words, I have a bias against remembering. Maybe some of you can answer this question for yourself. So I mean, I could be with my family and say, you know, wow, that was a great vacation we took back then. And they'll look at me and say, yeah, don't you remember what happened? The car broke down. We got literally kicked out of a campground, which actually did happen once. And, you know, and my positive but then we did that hike and it was wonderful and then we had that goofy meal we prepared and everybody was laughing. But don't you remember that, you know, Nikki and Chris got mad at each other and they were upset the whole night? Were they really? You know? Do any of you notice that you have a positive memory bias or a negative memory bias? Yeah. Is yours positive?
Most of the time.
How many of you have friends who you've noticed they are likely to, in the course of any conversation, they're likely to bring up negative things? They can still be your friend. Yeah. How many of you have friends, the opposite, right? Wow, you know, the person could have remarked at something bad that happened, but they just kind of glossed over it. Okay, so one of the things you might want to ask yourself is that variable? Is that something my culture gives me that I can't change? Is that part of my personality that doesn't change? Or can I cultivate, wow, what would this be like? Would I want to do this? Could I cultivate a positive memory bias? Would that be a good thing? I don't know. I mean, you might be torn between having an accurate memory. You might say, well, I want to have an accurate memory. That's what I want. And having a positive memory bias. Those are slightly interesting differences. Okay. Another methodological point, our nation's meaningful units of analysis. You might be wondering, why aren't we looking at ethnicity? Why are we looking at nations? And I've been puzzled by this. The best answer I've got is that our nation states are our comparison groups. What the article says is they predict happiness, differences in happiness, better than other measures. So the argument would be that it's your national political group that you look to for, I mean, we look to government to serve our needs as our national government. So nation states kind of make sense because we look for things from them and we compare ourselves to other people in our society more, right? Do you have something on this?
Well, I don't know if this has anything to
sure.
do with it, but it's all you can change your nation state as
right.
an individual, but you can't change your ethnicity.
Right. Right, so ethnicity would be a fixed feature, right? That's a good point. Yeah, did you have something on this too?
Yeah,
good.
And on that, wouldn't it mean that, like, let's say if you're Russian and then you move to the United States,
right.
your experience would be totally different than somebody who's American, born and bred?
So I would love to see research on this. My prediction is that if the dominant model is right, which is what Diener is representing here, you would expect the Syrians, a million Syrians migrated to Europe in the last 15 months, right? You would expect the affect profile of a Syrian who assimilates to start to match the affect profile of the country they move to. Now, I'm sure there's researchers who are going to look at that because we have opportunities with immigration. There could be some artifacts. After all, Syrians are coming out of a war. So their affect profile might be affected by that and going forward. Yeah, other thoughts about this?
Yeah. So are you saying there's a level of socialization to it? So,
yeah, good, go ahead.
You know, a Russian in Ukraine is still a Russian in all practicality, except by location, until they assimilate over time.
That's what we want to look at. Yeah, it'd be an interesting question. The assumption I would make, or the prediction I'd make, is that, yeah, you would expect it to track assimilation. I think that... So nation states make sense as units of analysis. They predict subjective well-being better than other factors. Like you said, ethnicity may not be as variable a character, so it might be. This might be a better dependent variable. Scale structure and variance sounds very technical. It is. I'll just give you the non-technical version. It's a really interesting problem. So happiness is part of a group of words that relate to happiness, right? Joy, sadness, etc. How do we know when we ask a Turk and a Micronesian and someone from Myanmar and somebody from Canada and South America and a country in South America, how do we know that they're clustering those meanings the same way? Because after all, the survey has a bunch of happiness words in it. It doesn't just say happy, it says, you know, do you experience joy frequently, things like that. So the point for your notes is, how do we know that people from different language groups are associating the meanings of happy words the same way in a survey? That could be a distorting influence, right? How do we know, I'll say it again, how do we know that people from different language groups or different nationalities are thinking about the relationships of meanings of happiness words the same way as other test subjects? There's some independent evidence that there is structural invariance, but it's not clear. It's a different version of the Gilbert problem about language squishing and experience stretching. Okay, so that's a concern about measurement, but I think there is some evidence that says it shouldn't be. Okay, let's get into I think this is the more interesting stuff, actually, which is that two big effects. One is a wealth effect, which, as we've acknowledged, is a clustering effect. You know, if you try the thought experiment, you could add, so the cluster is that it's hard to know how much freedom is makes you happy. We got some interesting new research on freedom and happiness in this Argyle project. it's hard to know how much freedom contributes to your happiness, because freedom comes along with rights that come along with democratic and wealthy cultures. So there's a cluster effect. So, I mean, could you imagine if the Nazis won World War II and we lived in a really wealthy but fascist state? You know, that would be a thought experiment to imagine happiness. Could you imagine that affecting your happiness? I could. I don't know. In other words, I'm a product of a culture that's a wealthy culture that also embodies democratic rights, which relate to control, which we have independent research on, is related to happiness. So we have mechanisms for each one, but they tend to be clustered together. And if you ask the counterfactual, you know, would you have been happy in a fascist society that was really wealthy? Yeah, I don't know what your intuition is. My intuition is, I don't know. I don't think I would be. Well, some of you might be like, I don't know. I don't really care about politics.
Do we have to disregard other, artifacts, like saying, you know, my grandfather fought in World War II, and the Nazis won as president? Like, I would have a negative.
Yeah, that's right. No, that would be it's an impossible thought experiment, because we're asking, you know,
yeah.
Right. But it would be even harder if you had an artifact like that in your past. Like, you lost a relative. I was thinking about this podcast I heard about Cuba and cuisine in Cuba, and how that, you know, this guy went back to Cuba to report on this, and he let somebody know that he was a reporter. And the woman said, well, you know, I'm supposed to let the government know that you just told me that you're a reporter, but I'll let it slide this time. I don't see myself happy in an environment like that. I think I'd like to visit Cuba, frankly, but that kind of world where you could be reported to a government official for saying something. So, my best guess is that I do experience independent commitments to some of the elements that are clustered in wealthy democratic rights-based cultures. But I don't know if you would say the same thing. It's a weird thought experiment. Okay, any thoughts on that? So just because it's a cluster, it doesn't mean that you aren't there. Each one isn't a legitimate commitment, a happiness commitment. Okay, the other one is individualism and collectivism. This is one that I think we should talk about in small groups. There's a bunch of details here. I'll just give you some of them. Individualistic cultures routinely report higher subjective well-being, but they also report higher levels of suicide. So that's another qualitative difference, right? So you could be happier in an individualistic culture, but there's other things that come along with it. So the question I want you guys to think about is, are collectivists working with a fundamentally different model of happiness? So individualism and collectivism tracks East and West cultures to some extent, though some Eastern cultures are becoming more individualistic. You might say that individualism is a great strategy because individualistic cultures report higher subjective well-being. But you might be suspicious about that. People in individualistic cultures think about their happiness more than people in collectivist cultures. Is that a good thing? I mean, would I feel liberated if I spent less time thinking about my happiness and I satisfied my happiness more through my relationships to family and community? So what I'd like you to think about is whether, go through this section, because there's more details than I'm rehearsing for you. It starts on page 441. But in group, just go through that next column on the next page. And then try to step back, see if anybody in the group has experience of the difference between collectivist and individualistic. You might have ethnic identities, the friendships that connected you to people in one culture or the other. Most of you are members of an individualistic culture. And then try to evaluate whether you think it's the same, whether you think that difference is really fundamentally a qualitative difference in happiness. Or can we ask the question, who's happier? There's two possibilities. They're comparative, and we can ask which kind of culture makes us happier, or they're not comparative, And all we can say is, that's not my culture. Or I'd kind of like to try that culture. Maybe I'd be happier in that culture. But there would be like jumping from one thing to another. It wouldn't, right? It wouldn't just be a difference in happiness. So try to do that in small group. Are individualists and collectivists pursuing the same model of happiness, fundamentally different models? Is there reason to think one is a better strategy than the other? And then try to personalize it. What, think about your own strategy. How much of an individualist are you going forward right now? And I'll tease that out a little bit too. Okay, let's try that for 5 minutes if we could. Okay, guys, maybe we could wrap this up and come back together. No. I mean, one way to ask this question is how many of you would put a value on staying close to your family as you start your careers? How many? Yeah. So that would be a way of locating a collectivist intuition. Say, wow, you know, I want to be near my family. I want to stay in the Northwest. That would be another, kind of like I feel connected to this place. That would be another word, wherever you're from. Yeah. What did you come up with in your groups? Does it make sense to compare these, or is this just like the difference between two different colors? Do any of you have experience with folks who are less invested in individualistic culture than most Americans? My Italian friends, sometimes they live in intergenerational households. So, you know, family raising kids, grandma's upstairs, somebody else's grandpa's down in the basement. And they sometimes they'll say to me, God, I wish I didn't have to do this. I wish I could be like you Americans and just kind of leave my family, go get a job in another city. You know, so the collectivist isn't always necessarily happy about that. Some people just talk about how they just couldn't imagine being happy, being very far from their family. That's the happy collectivist. Any thoughts from your group work? Yeah.
I didn't talk about this with them, but what
sure.
you just said about living together, like
yeah.
All of my friends back home in Canada, like they all go to college, but then they live with their parents at the same time, which to me, like, when they talk about how they think it's really great and everything, and I'm thinking in my mind, like, I would never want to go to college and live with my parents
right.
at the same
right.
time.
Italians
or
do it,
like,
too. They'll usually pick a university near where their family lives. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And
that
like,
didn't appeal to you at all.
Exactly.
Right.
And my
right.
my best friend, like, shares a bedroom with her little sister that's, like a freshman in high school. And to me, that just blows my mind. But she's totally content with it.
Yeah, right. It can work.
Yeah.
But because you guys have a model of college as a launching adventure, right? So we need an adventure. We can't just stay in the same room we grew up in. Yeah.
Well, I was kind of thinking out loud.
Sure.
I was thinking maybe that individualistic societies, they have like they maybe strive for happiness more than collectivist one, and collectivists might strive for other values or goals in life.
That's another way to put it. Yeah.
And maybe it's like. Maybe a measurement should be like, it's like feeling complete about life, and maybe that's not happiness to collective societies.
Yeah, there's another way of theorizing this where you say the difference between individualists and collectivists isn't different models of happiness, but emphasizing happiness versus not emphasizing happiness,
right.
And that is that there are theorists who will talk about it that way. I think most theorists talk about it in terms of, you know, collectivist happiness is a form of happiness. Individualist happiness is a form of happiness. But yeah, you could cash it out that way. Maybe it's just because after all, what we learned from this article is that the individualist is thinking about happiness a lot. So that would support your conjecture that maybe the collectivist really isn't valuing happiness. No, they're just valuing other social goods. They're certainly not valuing individual happiness as much. The reason I don't go that way is that I think when you read accounts of collectivists talking about happiness, they do talk about their happiness in terms of social commitments and duties and relationship. So I do think they're talking about happiness. There is a literature of people who say, well, happiness is a superficial thing to pursue. We'll get to that later. But yeah, good. Others? Anything else on this? Yeah. I thought, well, okay, you've got this, it's better because you've got data that says they're happier cultures, but, and we've also got data that rights cultures are, they poll well in collectivist cultures. There are a lot of people living in collectivist societies who would like to try individualism. Now, whether they have an accurate perception of the effects of that, I don't know, because after all, we have some bad things in individualistic culture. We have higher suicide, we have anomie, a kind of disaffection. You can read about that concept in sociology. There's a greater reported loneliness in individualistic cultures. But it might be liberating to think less about yourself. I don't imagine wanting to live in an intergenerational household. But it might be a richer kind of experience. I mean, you got babysitters. That was one problem we had.
So are Scandinavian countries more individualistic? Is that what
they're highly individualistic, but they're also very happy, yeah.
Okay.
No, they're highly individualistic cultures, yeah. They have, I should say this, though. Let's make a caveat on that. The Northern European social democracies have high levels of social trust.
Right.
So that's a collectivist virtue that we don't have. So it's not, but they don't typically live in intergenerational households. They tend to pursue the individual careers based on a perception of individual happiness, which is what we do, you know. What do you want to do with your life? Just decide for yourself. Don't decide based on what's available near us, you know. It's a free choice, right? So they'd be more like us that way, but they'd be less like us in terms of social trust. In fact, a lot of researchers say social trust is what distinguishes the northern social democracies. Yeah. And that sounds collectivist. Yeah. Okay, so that's a good initial run at that topic. I'll leave the models for explaining it to your study. I want to transition now in our last half hour to the Gilbert chapter, because there's a lot of really cool stuff in that. If you're interested in intercultural differences, there's plenty of more research you can do on it, and I'd be happy to help you with that. Okay. Let's get into Gilbert. I think he's got some interesting things to tell us today. We start with the comparison between Adolf Fischer and Eastman. Can anybody do that for me? It's puzzling, right? So Adolf Fischer is this revolutionary in the time of the Haymarket riots in Chicago. What happens to him?
Yeah. He gets accused of organizing the riots that... weren't some policemen injured when those riots were killed?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah,
I think
so,
some people were killed.
Okay, there was a bomb.
Yeah.
And so they tried him, they sentenced him guilty, and then they hung him.
And he's getting ready to be hung, and what did he say?
This is the happiest
thing. Oh, my God, it was crazy.
Yeah.
And he was falsely accused. Mm-hmm. He was sympathetic to the cause. So, and then Eastman is this incredibly successful business person, highly innovative person, you know, Eastman Kodak, kills himself, right? So that's the start of the chapter, and the point for your notes is that you can't understand someone's happiness without knowing the narrative. Right, you can't, and when he ends the chapter, he tells you the story behind each person, and of course, then it makes perfect sense. You can imagine this person being happy about being a martyr for this cause, and you can imagine the other person just not wanting to live. Yeah.
I read kind of, or this, those events reminded me of something similar.
Sure.
It was the death of Robin Williams, which was kind of like a shock to.
Right. Good example. That's a good. That's very. That was a sad case. Yeah.
And I hadn't really known the reason.
Yeah.
I read a recent article that said.
I didn't. What is it?
Or his wife apparently reported that he had a degenerative brain disease.
Oh, wow.
And only had like months until
wow.
he kind of went crazy.
Wow. I had
but
no
idea. I didn't know that before, and I thought it
yeah.
was just.
You know, it's a great example. Any example where you say, when you get the backstory, you're like, oh, that makes sense, you know. And part of it's because people are not transparent to us completely. You know, and we don't, but there's a deeper reason. Let's get to it. Okay. So before we get to the main reason, let's talk about some research that helps us see this. Okay, previously you got studies from Gilbert showing that we're not very good at comparing two experiences. Remember those, like yellow swatches? Now, this is the difference for your notes. Now we're going to get research that shows that, this is the key point, later experiences can change your memory of prior experiences. That's weird. Later experiences can change your memory of prior experiences. So the brain doesn't, it's not just spotty, it's not just selective in its attention, it actually reweaves its early experience based on later experiences, which makes comparing experiences even harder. That point was made earlier chapters. Okay, so we have a couple of research findings here. One is a study in which test subjects were shown a car approaching a yield sign, turning and hitting a pedestrian. Some test subjects were asked if they saw, if I can't remember the question,
if another car had passed the car prior to, like,
prior to
the road sign, is the question.
Yeah. Some people were asked a question in which the yield sign was changed
okay.
to a stop sign, right? So some test subjects were asked a question about a stop sign in the scenario. Then all test subjects were shown two pictures, one of the original scenario with the yield sign and one of the same scenario with the stop sign. and they were asked to identify which one they saw previously. The people who had been asked the question with the incorrect mention of a stop sign were more likely to choose the stop sign picture, okay? Not by a lot. It's like only 90% of the subjects who weren't asked got it right, but that's a pretty high percentage. 80% of the people who were asked chose... Wait, which one was it? 80% chose the stop sign? That would be a huge result. Wait a minute. Let's see which one it is. Was it really? 80? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's a huge result. That's not a small difference. Right. So 80% of the test subjects who were asked the incorrect question chose the stop sign picture. So the later experience, point for your notes, the later experience of the question with the incorrect mention of a stop sign changed the earlier experience scenario. Are we good? The wordless study example, it's really just an example, is another one. Where you get a bunch of words connected with sleep, and then you're asked which word wasn't there, sleep or gasoline. And you know gasoline. Your mind just knows that that's the one that doesn't fit. But sleep wasn't on there either. But you're not going to notice that sleep wasn't on there because all the words had to do with sleep. And then he gives you this example of the blind spot. So literally, we have a blind spot, right, in a part of our eye. And you can do the little exercise on page 82. But metaphorically, we have a huge blind spot because of this phenomenon of the way experience alters, subsequent experiences alter earlier experiences. Okay. So the main way to think about this difference is between two philosophers. And the philosophy majors and minors should be very excited that we're going to talk about Immanuel Kant for a few minutes here. Do we have some majors and minors? Right. So here's the difference. The difference between two models of the mind, one which takes into account this research and one which doesn't. So naively, you might think like John Locke, that the mind is kind of like a video camera, although Locke would not have made that comparison because he was writing a long time ago. But the idea is that, you know, early empiricists thought that that we learn about the world by taking it in. That's the key point for your notes, that we learn about the world empirically by experiencing it, but it comes into our minds. The idealist, and Kant is your man here, Locke's over here. The idealist argues that more consistently with this research that Gilbert's giving us, that we take in experience through our senses, but we actively construct, we take in data through our senses, but we actively construct experience because our mind exerts a structuring activity on our empirical experience. Our perceptions are not the result of physiological processes by which our eyes just transmit an image of the world into our brains, but rather the result of psychological processes that combine what our eyes see with what we already think, feel, know, want, and believe. Oh my gosh, this, we corrupt it. Or no, you could say we construct it. Because this, the realist possibility doesn't really exist. We don't do that. Okay? So, what we need to do is understand this idea, this idea that the mind plays an active role in manipulating sensory inputs to make sense of our world. We've seen some studies that suggest it, but one of the most powerful ways to see it is to understand what psychologists and philosophers call the false belief test. So I don't know, this wasn't in the chapter, but I want to bring it in here. How many of you have heard about the false belief test? No. Okay, good. That's exciting. I get to tell you about it. So this takes about 4 minutes. Just try to follow this. You may think of a good thing for human happiness about the fact that we have theory of mind.
I can say,
oh, you know, my friend always looks at the things this way, and, you know, she's happier than me. And so we can, put it in your notes this way, we can compare others, we can compare interpretations of the world and adopt other people's. Does that make sense as a result? That's good. That's a happy result. We're going to get some unhappy results as well. Yeah.
I feel like in some ways it makes social interaction better.
Yeah.
Because, or like, I mean, you can be, maybe it helps with empathy.
You couldn't have empathy without mind reading. Absolutely. You couldn't even experience the pleasures of empathy without mind reading. So it opens us up, let's put this in here, it's a very good result. It opens us up to very sophisticated and pleasures. Pleasures of friendship, right? There's all kinds of pleasures you can't experience unless you know there's other minds in the world. Good. Yes, you're a good happiness philosopher. Can you think about some more implications for happiness of theory of mind, of other minds? How about a negative one? How does theory of mind complicate happiness in a potentially negative way? And I'll just remind you of your middle school years here. Because remember middle school? Okay, that's talk about negative memory bias. No, maybe that was a positive time. It's a difficult time for a lot of people. Why? Because your theory of mind develops tremendously, right? All of a sudden you're in a world full of social drama and there's relationships at stake. And you have the possibility of the pleasure of relationships that you couldn't experience, you know, when you were in second grade. So that's the positive side, but what's the negative side of that? I'm just trying to stimulate that by recalling the middle school year.
By not knowing how much to value someone else's opinion.
Yeah.
So you turn to a people pleaser and you just do everything
yeah.
for everyone else.
A world of other minds raises the frightening possibilities of anxiety, lack of social acceptance, being judged negatively by others, and not finding out. Or finding out. You know? So a social world is a wonderful thing. It makes possible pleasures you couldn't have otherwise, but it's a horrible thing. It's a horrible thing because it could be that you latch on to the wrong advice. It could be that you read the wrong mind. It could be that you try to please, you become a people pleaser. You try to adapt yourself to what the minds around you seem to want rather than what would make you happy, right? So, you know, sometimes you get the freshman coming in as your advisee and saying, well, everybody's been telling me to become a doctor, but this is really, I don't like doing this. And it was halfway through fall semester before that really got to a point where the person said, I've spent a lot of time being told that I should do this. And, you know, it happens almost every year, frankly, you know. That's a little bit of an exaggeration. It happens a lot. Why? Because social learning, let's connect the dots between the first part of the class and the second part. Living in a world of other minds is partly what makes social learning possible. Social learning is what we were talking about earlier in the day in the class about the basis of cultural, national cultures of happiness, individualistic, collectivist, right? You grow up in a culture and because you have theory of mind, you pick up the cues, not when you're three, but as you get older. In middle school, you pick up the cues about what's cool and what's not. It's terribly oppressive for some people. Remember that? I'm sorry, maybe you had a better middle school experience than I did. It was a long time ago for me. So social learning presents the possibilities for some of the greatest forms of happiness we can have, because we can have happiness with other people in a kind of intimacy that we couldn't have if we didn't recognize other minds. But it poses tremendous negative possibilities because we could be constrained. Let's put in your notes a couple of points. Negative possibilities of theory of mind. It's how we engage in social learning, which could be oppressive. Social learning could limit our sense of possibilities of how we could pursue our happiness. Other people can be cruel. They can make us anxious. They can make us feel shame. So we're complicating the problem of happiness a lot today. Again, we're talking about the brain. We're talking about something that the mind can do that's remarkable for happiness in some profoundly positive and profoundly negative ways. And that's how you can understand Adolf Fischer and Eastman, right? Because when you get the narratives of their lives, you understand how their biographies have involved interacting with other minds and valuing things like, you know, radical politics in one case or building a business in another, and how those things present positive and negative possibilities, right? So here's this example. I'll close with this example about imagining a plate of spaghetti. You imagine a plate of spaghetti, you carry out the exercise, and you fill in all kinds of results, all kinds of aspects that you imagine for the plate of spaghetti. And you don't even notice that you're doing it. You know, you're drawing on resources to predict a future happiness, and it's not clear if those resources are reliable for you. Okay, let's stop there. See you guys on Thursday.